This is tape two of the interview with Steve Mouchet.
It's actually tape three.
Tape three. That's right. Tape three. Thank you. When the tape ended, we last side of the tape, we were talking about somewhat of the rivalry between the U of M stations, radio and broadcasting, and Michigan. And
we've always gotten along.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we've always been the envy, I think, of some of the other stations in other states, because the Michigan public radio and public TV stations have always worked closely together. And in the, I think it was probably in the 60s, late 60s, maybe early 70s, we did lots of, not lots, but we would do occasional joint program projects where we'd take some kind of topic of statewide interest and then link together the stations with some kind of a clunky setup where we'd relay our parts off the air. So we'd actually, be like, all right, so this first segment will be 10 minutes long and it'll be done at the University of Michigan. And the way we'll get it on WKAR's air is to tune in the University of Michigan in the auditorium building station and put it into the WKAR transmitter. And then they would finish and then we would do our part and they would tune us in down there. And
sounds pretty complicated.
It was clunky too. But, we did that with U of M, Western Michigan, MSU, and we still today still work closely together and have a state association that meets regularly, along with the TV people. That's also unusual. In some states, the public TV people hardly ever relate to the public radio people. In Michigan, our association is both public radio and TV.
Were you involved in that?
I was the chairman of the board a few years and on the executive committee, and I've been quite involved in that.
Was that state-funded, or did you have...
Oh, no. It's a nonprofit corporation that's funded by the stations itself.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We were talking a little bit about the covering of state affairs, state government.
Mm-hmm.
Did John Hanna support that in the early stages, or was it something else?
I admire John Hanna so much, and of course he was the president when I came here as a student, but I never knew John Hanna.
Okay.
And I don't recall ever receiving any kind of feedback one way or the other. From the Hanna administration. Now, I was not the manager during a lot of that time, but I certainly, the university never said, we want you to go in this direction, or we don't want you to. In fact, that's one of the things I am absolutely the proudest about MSU in terms of its relationship with the public radio and TV stations, and that is, having spent years and years and years with my colleagues who were at other university and college stations, and having heard horror stories about how their administration had interfered in one way or another with the programming on the station. And where it gets especially dicey is in news. If you have a story that you report and it's negative about MSU, there can be people, at the university who will be angry about that.
Public relations.
And if at any time somebody, at least we always strongly and still do till today, felt that if any person in the administration told us, you should not have done that story because it reflected MSU in a negative way, and don't ever do stories again that are negative toward MSU, that would become a serious problem for us, because that would totally compromise our journalistic integrity. So therefore, other stations would be reporting this story, the newspapers would be reporting this story, but we would be saying nothing. And I am, like I said, based on horror stories from other stations, not once in my entire career here did anyone make us change programming or not report something? Mm-hmm. There were little incidents from time to time where people were mad because we did something, and they would call us up or tell us that they weren't happy, and we would say, well, but we have a job to do, and that really has to be the way it is. We hope you can accept that.
Mm-hmm. With the publication of the Ramparts article that dealt with the issue of the involvement of MSU in the Vietnam War.
I had completely forgotten. Oh, my goodness, Ramparts. I remember that. Yes.
I think that was 1966. But I wondered if there was any repercussions, if that was covered or on the radio.
You know, that was so long ago. I don't remember. But boy, I do remember that controversy.
We're talking about some of the role of MSU in training the South Vietnamese police force on campus and the allegations about CIA connections and that sort of thing. But I didn't know if that was one of the controversies that the station avoided.
I don't remember it as being something that. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't avoid things.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't remember us ever getting criticism for doing anything about that. But I'm not sure what we did about it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, obviously some of the sports scandals and that sort of thing was. Maybe we could talk a little bit about sports programming. How did you balance that? Were there some people that wanted all sports, or
it was all sports all the time? It was. Actually, it kind of used to drive me crazy because we broadcast everything. Mm-hmm. Football, basketball, baseball, hockey. And the baseball was, I mean, sports was always strong. Mm-hmm. And with the leadership of, I mentioned Jim Adams and Terry Braverman, I forgot Bob Shackleton, who was here. Jim was Bob's assistant. And it was Bob and Jim at the time. But the baseball was the most frustrating because it came right in the middle of the afternoon during the weekday. You never knew how long it would last. And if it got rained out, then they'd change it. And the next day, when you thought it was going to be a single game, suddenly became a doubleheader or something. And it was just... like, you'd wring your hair. It was like, this is disruptive, you know. But there were people who liked it. I mean, and we kept doing, we ran the statewide football network for years, where if you wanted to listen to MSU football on a Saturday afternoon on your little local station in Petoskey, it would be Jim Adams and Bob Shackleton. That's who you'd listen to. Mm-hmm. And I believe in the later years, then we also programmed it in a way so that there were opportunities for those local commercial stations to cut away and run commercials. Mm-hmm. Eventually, that all went away. I don't know how the baseball and that kind of sport went away. I think it went away because we finally convinced people or convinced ourselves that as we became more sophisticated and were fundraising and wanted to reach more listeners without compromising the type of programming we did, that you can't break a format, which is what we call it. So you can't have classical music every day except, we're not going to play any classical music today. We're going to have 2.5 hours of baseball on the radio. Mm-hmm. But the football prevailed for a long time, and especially on the TV station, because it wasn't available. And now, of course, you can watch every basketball game, you can watch every football game, and you can watch the hockey games on the cable channels. Mm-hmm. So the necessity, I guess, if that's the correct word, for doing that on the radio went away in that regard. Mm-hmm. But, oh, yes, lots of sports. Yeah. There was the TV show Spartan Sportlight on WKR, and there were We did a show every day called News 60. We did a 60-minute news program on the radio station. And there was sports sections and hard news sections and features. And it's a pretty dramatic undertaking for the Times to do a 60-minute program every day. Mm-hmm. Of course, we did it, I think it was at 6. Might have moved it to 5. Mm-hmm. 6 today would be... You wouldn't want to put anything on it today.
your listening audience would probably not be...
Well, all things considered, that's pretty good at 6 o'clock. But mm-hmm. Wouldn't want to waste a lot of local news, public affairs energy at 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Too much competition from television.
Did was there a relationship with on-campus broadcasting, or is it instructional television? Were you involved in that at all?
My only involvement, of course, I ended up being director of instructional television and the TV eventually, mm-hmm. but not until the late 80s. Mm-hmm. My only involvement with instructional television was when I was teaching the broadcast courses right after I got my master's degree. I also taught a course in television and radio announcing. And for the television announcing course, we did it in the instructional TV studios, which were in Erickson Hall. Mm-hmm. At the time, instructional television and public television were two separate entities. They had not been merged. Mm-hmm. And that was my only really contact with those folks. And then ironically, it turned out that 20 years later, almost 25 years later, I ended up having a responsibility for that instructional television and working with some of the same people who helped me when I was teaching this television announcing course, because I knew nothing about television, but I was teaching television announcing. It was like, okay, I can teach announcing, but so we did, you know, okay, students, now it's time to do the weather forecast. Mm-hmm. Be like, help me out here, instructional TV people. Mm-hmm. Take care of these cameras for me, will you? Because I don't know how to do anything with a camera.
Mm-hmm. Was Kent Creswell involved in that?
I don't know if Kent was at that time. Mm-hmm. Erling Jorgensen was the pioneer of the instructional TV stuff.
And, on campus.
And Kent did come here later mm-hmm. from Ohio State as the associate director. And then Kent worked for me when I was director of broadcasting services, heading up the instructional arm of that. And there was a time, I think it was probably in the 70s, when there were these really prestigious program awards called the Ohio State Awards. Ohio State ran a competition for these television and radio awards competition. And Kent was a judge running a judging center. And I worked with Kent as a judge each year, judging those award submissions. So that was my first real contact with him. Mm-hmm. Later on, I ended up doing that, running a judging group here on campus in the 90s. Mm-hmm. The awards have since disappeared.
The how did your nature of your job change from between the 70s and the 80s? Was there...
Yep. To me, it wasn't as dramatic as between the 60s and 70s. Okay. I think the most significant, there were a couple of significant changes. Of course, one was the most dramatic in terms of facilities was moving to the Communication Arts Building mm-hmm. in 1981. Also, in the mid-70s, NPR moved to the satellite network, so for the first time we were capable of getting multiple radio channels from satellite, and we were selected to be one of only, I think it was about 15 public radio stations that not only had a downlink capability to receive the programming, but also an uplink, so we could transmit to the entire public radio system via satellite. That was pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was really quite technically interesting, how you could take a signal and beam it 22,000 miles up in the air and then capture it at another public radio station in California. Mm-hmm. Today it's not so dramatic.
People have it on their homes, a little small dish.
And interestingly enough, as a matter of fact, so that was such a big deal to have that satellite uplink in the mid-70s. About 3 or 4 years ago, we packed it up, all the electronics, for transmitting radio, and sent it back to NPR. We decommissioned the uplink part, because that's not the way you do things anymore. Mm-hmm. It's all over the internet or fiber optic lines. We still have a TV uplink, because a little harder yet to do high-quality video that way. Mm-hmm. But you know that we'll be doing it that way soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
So that, you let's see, this was 70s to 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, NPR became, you know, the public radio audience started growing dramatically. Mm-hmm. The whole fundraising audience thing dramatically changed. We did our first on-the-air fundraiser in 1975. I remember it because we set up the newsroom in the cramped auditorium as the area we did the pitches from. And we raised $10,000 in 1975. That was the total amount of money we raised from listener contributions. Today the radio station is over $1 million, the TV station over $2 million every year.
Wow.
We did not do underwriting, those underwriting announcements that we public broadcasters have all been trained to call them underwriting. Announcements, even though everybody else calls them commercials. There really is a difference. But boy, they're pushing the line these days, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's quite a contrast. It seems like it wasn't one of the first ones, the mobile, a Masterpiece Theater, that connection, that was about as close to
yeah.
it. Endorsement that was early must have been
substantial. Yeah, that's mild compared to today, though.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's really quite mild.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where you're seeing the product and you're hearing the pitch. And
you're not allowed to say, buy this product.
Uh-huh.
You're allowed to show the product. You can't urge people to take action. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you still can't interrupt a program, which is the way certainly it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of research. I mean, from time to time we get people who complain about it, but there is a lot of research that shows that people do understand the necessity of that.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in that fundraiser?
Yes.
Very first one?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Did the university start withdrawing some of the support, or did that, in relationship to that, or it seems like that was a tough balance?
You know, and that was always a fear of mine, that they would say, well, if you're fundraising, we'll just offset our support by the amount you raise every year. I don't believe that happened.
Mm-hmm.
There were periods when things were tough economically in the state and others, as I'm sure history has recorded here for sure, 1981,
mm-hmm.
And the modified coordinated proposals, where they took $17 million, I believe, out of the MSU budget. Mm-hmm. MSU did at the time. Cecil Mackey was the president. And that was the first time ever until 2 years ago, that we actually had to lay off employees because the budget cuts were so extreme, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, in mm-hmm. 1981. Since then, actually, the MSU support has not gone up. In fact, it hasn't even kept pace with inflation, but probably neither is the MSU overall budget.
Mm-hmm.
But MSU is still, I think, quite generous in its support, even though we got a big budget cut 2 years ago. But again, it was a rough time and ended up having a couple of layoffs. Again, I mean, the combination, the funding model now, I think is a really good funding model,
mm-hmm.
where MSU pays for some of it, Some of it comes through congressional appropriations, and the listeners or viewers pay for the rest. And the listener viewer support is about 50%. And I think that's good, that, that nobody really is the majority owner, even though, of course, MSU owns the license. So they really do control the stations.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that the radio was able to maintain that, that level of giving, or not surprised with that?
Actually, radio has done quite well. Mm-hmm. In terms of the listener support, radio has done quite well. TV is struggling these days because there's just so much competition. So many cable channels. And public radio and TV people tend to lose sight of reality sometimes. And I remember when we, one of the very first public TV meetings I went to in 1989 or 1990, and they had this elaborate presentation about how public TV had nothing to fear from cable television because the public television national audience was bigger than all those cable networks, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel, Food Network, CNN, ESPN, bigger than all their viewers combined. And that was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not true at all today. Yeah. No way.
Mm-hmm. That was, you know, they were ignoring that, I think.
Well, and there was
misjudging it.
Discovery Channel was spending more money on advertising than public television was spending on programming in a year.
Wow.
How do you compete with that?
Yeah. It's interesting. How in the 19, you went into more into administration in the 1980s?
Yeah. Well, I was the radio general manager starting in 1978.
Okay.
But then in 1980, Bob Page, who had been the TV manager for years and years and years, retired. And Irv Bettinghouse, the Dean of College of Communication Arts, who was our the area we reported to at the time. We've been all over this university in terms of changing reporting relationships over the year. But at that point in time, it was Communication Arts and Sciences. And Irv Bettinghouse came to me and said, Bob Page is retiring. I'd like you to be on the search committee he said, I'd like you to also be, if you're willing, the acting director of the TV station as well as the radio general manager. Or if you're a candidate for the job, then tell me and we won't do that. And I said, well, let me think about it. And I thought about it and I said, the next day I said, I can't give up radio because it was, you know, are you going to become a candidate to become the director of the TV station and somebody else would run the radio station? Remember, they're still separate, even though we're in the same building now. And I said, I can't give up radio. So I'll be the acting director for TV and do the radio job and you go find yourself a TV manager. And I was on the search committee. And after 2 years of being acting TV director, along with my radio job, and the search committee becoming frustrated because a couple of people who were offered the position eventually declined, they suddenly realized that they could save some money and create some synergy if they combined the television and radio administration, as I had mentioned earlier, like it was at most universities. So they asked me, they created a new position. The Board of Trustees created a new position, Director of Broadcasting Services, and made me the Director of Broadcasting Services. So that's what I began doing in 1989. Mm-hmm. So it was now like, oh my, I've been doing radio for all these years, and suddenly we're into the world of television. This will be interesting. And it was interesting. I had to keep telling people at the TV station, look, you produce those programs. We'll talk about where, what direction we're going in and stuff, but just remember one thing. Steve has never produced a television program in his life. I'll try to figure this out, mm-hmm. but I can't direct a TV show mm-hmm. because I used to do radio. Well, it worked out pretty good. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it, and I think we accomplished some things.
Who were some of the producers that you relied on that to hold up the leg of the
Actually, many
TV.
Of them are still there.
Oh, really?
And
uh-huh.
some of the legendary ITV producers, now they're all gone now, but Dick Brundle, Gary McQuaig here suddenly is working for me at in the 1990s, and he was my director that helped me do that television announcing class in Erickson Hall. And the TV people, directors, many of whom are still there too, some of whom retired. One of my early TV stories that kind of summed up my baptism to TV was, because I always had an interest in programming, I took a real interest in television, public television programming, which was unusual because for some bizarre reason, public TV managers tend not to be involved very much in programming. And I took a real interest in it and learned a lot that way. But I also made my early mistakes in TV by not understanding how it worked. And one of my favorite early on stories was they were programming the television station and they had the ability to videotape programs fed from PBS and schedule them at other times. So if you had a children's show that you wanted to show, you could record it when it was fed off the satellite at 7 a.m., but you wanted it to be on at 10 a.m., then you'd play the tape back at 10 a.m. And we were doing some things that I thought were kind of goofy, so I said, well, I don't understand why you're recording this, playing this, you're doing that. And they said, well, that's the only way we can do it. We have to do it that way. We don't like doing it this way either, but there's no other way to do it. And I said, well, why is there no other way? And they said, well, we don't have enough tape machines. I said, you don't have enough videotape machines. I said, in radio, if we don't have enough tape machines, we go buy one. They cost $2,000. Then they said, Steve, welcome to television. Do you know how much a television tape machine costs? I said, I have no idea. Just go buy one. Uh-huh. And they said, oh, okay. Where's the $30,000 coming from? And I said, oh, okay. I guess we won't be buying a tape machine soon, will we?
$30,000.
What a contrast. Radio's so simple compared mm-hmm. to TV. One person on radio can go off and do a program from start to finish. Mm-hmm. TV, it takes, you do a big studio production, it takes 11 people.
Mm-hmm. Was MSU producing many TV programs when you took over?
We had a little niche. We had a little niche where we were producing because there was a man at the television station for years who was an absolute legend. His name was Dr. Donald Pash, and he produced a series called Young Musical Artist, and some of the most famous American musicians today, when they were very young and undiscovered, came to MSU and performed, and Don Pash created, all the way back into black and white and then into color, programs with these performances of these artists. He became an absolute legend because it was such an incredible niche that nobody else was into. And he had retired, I think he retired shortly after I became the acting director. He now lives in Chicago. And we decided we wanted to try to maintain some of that fine arts tradition. So we did hire a young man who was a music, Eric Schultz was his name, MSU music graduate with some TV interest, and we created a series of programs that were what I would call now not just a straight performance, but kind of performance documentaries. And we didn't do very many because they just took so long to produce and they were so elaborate. But those were distributed nationally on PBS. We did the one of the last ones we did was the Ellen Zwillick Commission for the Gardens, the children's gardens, the symphony that she performed, that she wrote, and was performed here at Wharton Center, the world premiere of her symphony. I think it was her fifth symphony. We did a documentary about all her visits to MSU and studying the gardens and composing. Went to New York. Eric went to New York to her studio, and did a documentary about how she wrote this symphony, and did then did a documentary of the performance of the actual symphony. We won an Emmy Award for that.
Wow.
And